Prophet's profession. We resolved to have this workshop today because before us the expropriation bill of number B23 of 2020, and we then in terms of our process plan agreed that it is important that before we receive the briefing from the department, let's stick in our understanding so that at least there is a convergence of the appreciation of what does the concept mean. And as a result thereof, we then agreed that we invite the team member, Professor Monsters, and also, as she has already indicated, there is she's accompanied by Mr. Haupaluri Matiwa and also Dr. Richard Kramer. With us on the platform is members of the State Committee of Transport, Public Works, and Infrastructure, Public Service and Administration, and Monitoring and Evaluation. This is the cluster committee that we are members of. Myself, my name is Kim Wima. As the chairperson of the committee, I'll request the members of the committee that are on the platform to introduce themselves.
Okay, today seeing nobody starting, I will start. I'm Sonia Bosso, member of this committee, and I represent Mpumalanga. Thank you very much.
Muhammad Dango, a member of this committee, and I represent Gauteng.
Can you show your face, Badala?
There we are.
There we are. Thank you.
Yes, let's proceed to Moshori.
No, I read for it already.
Mama Rakhane.
Mama Rakhane.
Mama Rakhane.
Hello.
Yes, my name is Khalid Mamarekhani, member of the Mamarekhani, member of the committee, and I represent Limpopo province.
Thank you, Mamarekhani.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Good morning. My name is Honorable Mishodi. I represent the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Mishodi. The other members on the platform.
Honorable Chairperson.
Hi, Tim.
Honorable Chairperson, I greet you from my vehicle because I have to travel somewhere where I have signal because of load shedding, unfortunately.
Okay, Tim.
My name is Tim Brouterset and I represent KZN on this committee. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Tim. AJ.
Chairperson?
Yes, Spiller.
Maybe also take this opportunity to allow members of the provincial legislature who are here also to introduce themselves.
I see the Silver Stallone first before that. Madam Lund.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, I just had to switch to the inverter. Obviously, you would know that very well, as your party nature sits in this mess. But you know, it's a daily frustration that I'm here. Sorry for being a few minutes late.
Can we then have members of the provincial legislature that I was asked?
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to yourself and other honorable members and other guests on the platform. I'm Dr. Namathemba Mukheti, representing Housing, DID Portfolio Committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mukheti. okay? Restate.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Connie. I'm the legal advisor. I'm just quickly checking with the chairperson if she's able to check in. Thank you, chairperson. From Facebook.
Okay, brilliant. Let's go to Limpopo. Look what I mean, Mpumalanga.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Associate Saba Muset. I'm the legal advisor. I'm just checking the chair because I don't see him on the connection. But as soon as we find him, we'll be able to get him. But be rest assured that the legal advisor is in attendance, Chair.
From which province?
It's Mpumalanga Provincial Legislature, Chair.
Thank you. Northern Cape. Northwest. But can you then have the staff introducing themselves?
So sorry, Chairperson. From Limpopo. My name is Temi Khosa. I'm the legal advisor to attach to the Portfolio Committee on Public Works. We're still waiting for the chairperson to connect, but I'm here representing the Limpopo Legislature from Legal Services. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Tony. Can we have the committee staff introduce themselves?
Good morning, Chairperson. I'm sorry to interrupt, Chair. My name is Nani Chabazayo. I'm the legal advisor at the Eastern Cape Provincial Legislature. I'm trying to get hold of the chairperson, as soon as I find him, he will join the meeting. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you.
Chairperson, may I note an apology, please?
Yes, that's him.
Chairperson, my colleague in the KZN legislature, Marlene Nair, that's N-A-I-R, she has just apologized because they were only notified of this sitting. Of this meeting yesterday. Unfortunately, they have a human settlements meeting today, so she just apologizes for her absence. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yes,
Sabuna
from the platform.
Yes, Chairperson, before you move to the staff members, I'm Lillian Managa from Limpopo Legislature, Public Works, Roads and Infrastructure Portfolio Committee. I'm with Semi Khosa. We are still waiting for the chairperson, like our legal advisor has already said it. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria. Can we have committees?
Good morning, chairperson.
Good morning.
Dr. Aniki? Good morning, Chairperson, members and guests. My name is Anissa Clark and I am the content advisor supporting this committee.
Thank you. Researcher?
Oh, Chairperson, the researcher has apologized. He's going to join us after 10 o'clock.
Okay. There's
no problem with connectivity.
All right. Do you have Zuki, sir, on the platform?
Zolifa? No, I don't see her.
Okay. All right. Can you then can you introduce the prof so that we can then introduce the team?
Sorry, Chairperson.
Chairperson, before that, if I may,
yes,
before that,
yes, Ambassador,
we may have some housekeeping things to do, so I would appeal to members to please stay on to deal with housekeeping matters that we may have to deal with after the presentations.
Brilliant. That's good work. Yes, Melela.
Greetings, Chairperson, and the members and everyone in the platform. I'm also Kumele Lenge, my legal advisor in Parliament. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Can we then have the Prof introducing herself and the Chief? Prof Master?
Good day. I'm wondering whether you can see me.
We can't see you.
Let me try this one. Yes.
Okay.
I am Henry Mostert. I am the Saatchi Chair for Mineral Law in Africa at UCT, and with me, first let me change my camera and you can see them all, is Dr. Richard Kramer. He is a postdoctoral fellow at the research chair, and Mr. Halpa Lelwa Matiba. He is a doctoral researcher at the chair and also a senior lecturer in property law at UCT. We're looking forward very much to engaging with you.
Thank you, Prof. By so doing, I'm giving you now the platform to hit the ground running. Welcome, Prof. and your chief. The floor
Thank
is yours.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right. I'm going to try to share a screen. Let me see if I can share it from here. That will have to be the screen. Share the screen. You can just give me a confirmation that you can see the screen, please.
Yes, Prof. Master, you can see the screen.
You can see a slide? Right. Just a portion, that's what they will see. And now I just want to change the video. There you go. Right. Thank you, colleagues. Thank you very much for inviting us to come and talk to you on the expropriation bill and some of the concepts within it. We are very much honored by the invitation that Ms. Clark has provided for us. Perhaps, Chairperson, if I can just check with you in terms of protocol, screen protocols, do you want the video off or on?
I think now you are fine. If your bandwidth is okay, then there's no problem.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. So, yes, thank you very much. We are then going to fall right into talking about the expropriation bill. And as I've mentioned already, I've introduced the team. It's myself, Dr. Richard Kramer, and Mr. Gopa Lewa Matiba. We form part of the MILIA, the Mineral Law in Africa research team that is hosted by the University of Cape Town. And our research interests focus on natural resources and the role players that influence the governance and law around natural resources. I am also part, a founding member of the expert group on expropriation law, which is based in the Netherlands. And I have provided you with the information of their website here. If you have any questions or any further interest in the expropriation topic, then that is a good place to start looking for partners and building a network. Let's get into talking about the expropriation bill. The way in which we've planned this is that each of us will talk on a particular one or two of the topics that you have briefed us for. That is the program, brief introduction, and then I am going to talk about the two questions: where does the power to expropriate come from, and who can expropriate? And Dr. Kramer will be talking about what can be expropriated, and Mr. Matiba will be talking about when can one call it expropriation. We're going to keep the discussion fairly high level, but we have a lot more background information that we are very keen to share with you, so we would like to invite you to ask as many questions as you want. We have prepared, each of us has prepared about 10 to 15 minutes, maximum 20 minutes of talk that there are for you to engage with us, and we're looking forward to that. I am then going to start with the first question on our menu, which is the
Prof, you can see the video of
the power to expropriate.
Prof, I was suggesting that maybe you can see the video of so that you are
that
more
better?
No, I'm just saying that we can hear you now. We can hear you now.
Okay. All right. With the slide, I see on ours, please, can you just give me an indication of that?
Yes, we can see the screen.
And it's not flickering?
No, it is not.
Okay, good. So, we're locked into two computers, and the one is not happy that it is not the main computer. I'll be talking about the origins of the power to expropriate. It was really, I'm very pleased that you asked me to be involved, because it was nice for me to return to this kind of work and look at this. So this is the question: where does the power to expropriate come from? So I am going to talk a little bit about the concept eminent domain, because the power to expropriate is inherent to the state's eminent domain, and where this comes from. Where did it all start?
Chairperson, I wonder if we can ask Prof just to look at and if ITC can assist us.
Yes.
Chairperson?
It looks like the Prof
Chairperson, while we have this break, I mean, this reinforces the call that we've given quite a few times, that maybe we should start moving back to having in-person sessions. Then you can ensure that there's, if people do have to link in from outside, one device that works, but those people that can come through in person, we can actually do that and not have these interruptions, because we're losing quite a bit of time. It's not any of the presenters' fault. It's because our towers are down. It is because people don't have power at home. So I am sure that this is not an unreasonable request, and that you will reconsider the previous times we submitted the request and it was turned down.
Yes, yes, I think it's a reasonable one. A reasonable one, honorable lord.
Chairperson, could you please tell me what you can see now?
Yeah, we can see now where it's at. But we lost you for the last, I suspect, a minute or two.
Yes. I apologize. I don't know why it was doing that. So let's just start here. And that question is very intimately linked to the question, where does the state come from? So that's my slide, is where did it all start? There are many theories about where the state comes from. It has a very history. The theory of the state has a very long history. I'm not going to get too much into that, but I do want to talk about the idea, which is across various political there was a state, there was freedom. There was individual freedom and there was profit, but this requires living in a state of individual freedom and freedom of property requires quite a lot of the individuals and the property holders. They have to protect what is theirs and what they value themselves, and it can get quite stressful. So if you can look at this next slide, for instance, on the circle with various segments, you different individuals living in a circle, which is where there is no formal state around, they have to protect their property themselves, they have to protect their individual liberties themselves, and it can place quite a lot of strain on individuals. It also creates a situation of uncertainty and insecurity because of this or interferences with individual liberty. That is why, and this is the theory of Richard Epstein. He says the simplest way to understand this problem of what to do with property and liberty if there isn't a protective mechanism around it, it has a layer around all the individuals within it. So if you look at the two pies, the pie on the left represents a world without the effective control that the government can exert. In other words, a world without the state. And in such a world, individuals have rights and freedoms, protecting their rights. And when they encounter others who want to interfere with their rights and freedoms, they have to protect themselves. It can become a very vicious world. A lot of energy expended by individuals simply protect what values. And this brings about a lot of uncertainty, as individuals must constantly be alert to potential infringements on the persons or the property. And living with such insecurity makes it difficult to plan, and it can be very costly, and that is what Epstein refers to as the state of nature. It individuals are to organize themselves politically, they relinquish slivers of their freedom and individual rights to gain the protection of a group or a polity. So in being politically organized, in organizing themselves within a state, individuals can make social gains. This is what Richard Epstein says. He says the fall, this falls within the protection of the collective. So if they organize themselves within a polity or a community, they get the protection of everybody in the community. They can share resources. They still enjoy the individual rights, but within the context of the group. And they must tolerate that some elements are sacrificed to the group. So what the group, the collective, offers is a police power. That is the power to protect and regulate, to preserve the essence of every individual's rights. And the appointed government, or let's call it, keeping the peace and protecting the boundaries of individual rights and interests. But inevitably, the way in which a group organizes, in which it forms a state, will require property holders to release of powers over their property. Resources, or some of their resources, get transferred from private to public hands. And property holders will, because property holders will not easily relinquish what is theirs, this, to take from such holders what the state needs for the proper functioning of society. And that is the origin of the power to appropriate. That to take what is necessary is called the state's eminent domain. And it is the power to expropriate that is firmly rooted in that inherent power of the state to eminent domain. That power of that state is also worth state sovereignty, and as you know, sovereignty is protected by various international instruments. So I'm going to move on to, or perhaps maybe I should just return to the previous slide. I can just move this to give you a different kind of depiction. There was freedom and property, individuality and property, but it makes it difficult to organize and protect rights and freedom. Banding together within a community, within a state, allows a group of individuals to regulate regulation, gaining of territory, that can organize themselves, they gain sovereignty. So this is a quote that I would, so actually, the state is given extraordinary the power to expropriate, what it means and what it enables a state and its civil servants to do. So within this theory, they say there are only two problems. They say little trouble. The answer for that, organized within a state, is that the state has police power, that it can roll private aggression on behalf of all the individuals that form the state. And then the other problem is for power, how to exercise power. With the formation of the state, power is it enables everybody in that society to organize according to numbers. And that is what the eminent domain, the inherent power of the state called eminent domain, is about. So the natural next question that comes from that theory is, what can and should the state do with power to expropriate?
And the answer to that is that it is the responsibility of the state to ensure the fair distribution of resources. So fair is on and should the state do to expropriate. In order to ensure that fairness, expropriation is very typically and globally now down two requirements. The one, that means the compensation is a precondition for fair the state's distributive powers. The other requirement is that the state's coercive power, the power of the state to take property, is limited by the requirement that the taking must be for a public use, or as our constitution says, public or public interest. These two requirements are fairly standard across all jurisdictions in the world, and these two requirements are present to ensure that the state exercises that very potent ability to take property from private individuals in a fair manner. The next question I want to talk to is, it has actually two sides. On the one hand, it is how the power to expropriate can shape a society, and how society can shape the power to expropriate. And I think that is exactly what the honourable members of this committee and the members of Parliament are busy doing, reconceptualising how our society can shape the power to expropriate, but at the same time thinking how the power to expropriate can shape. Mentioned already, I showed you this slide around expropriation can shape a society and how society can shape the power to expropriate. Show you the two poles, the two polar opposites of what can happen. Can you hear me?
My apologies, Prof. Yes. We lost you when we were dealing with how the power to expropriate can shape society and how society can shape the power to expropriate. We lost you there.
Show you the polar views of what such a
future shaping could look like. So on the one side of the slide, you see that the word liberalist or minimalist, that is when the members of the society has the view that the state should stay out of social and market transactions, or that it must limit its role to simply enforcing contracts among private entities and ensuring the public order. So to summarize this, shorthand for this is the view that the state must be small. On the other side of the screen, on the other side of this pole, on the other pole of this idea, is the what is referred to as territorialist. That is a territorialist view that the state has complete control and regulation of as many aspects as possible of what happens inside its boundaries. So that's how we call the big state. So these are the little state versus the big state. Views about the two extremes on the spectrum of how the state should organize itself. And these extreme views would have an influence on how the what the politics around expropriation would be in a particular given state. I have to add that these are extremes, and barely any state finds themselves so much on an extreme as these two represent. Most of the states find themselves within an organizational model somewhere in between these two extremes. But the point is that the justification of expropriation will be informed by how one views the state's organization. So the question about how the power to expropriate can shape society and how society can shape the power to expropriate very much depends on this question of how society sees its relationship with the state. Do they want a little state or do they want a big state? In the African context, take it one step further to talk about the role of expropriation in a typical post-colonial transformative context. This question of the small state or the big state has played itself out again and again in different countries. And researchers that work on talk about the oscillation of policy, like a spiral within a particular state or a society. And the typical trajectory is as follows. Many of the states immediately, many of the African states were colonized, and during colonization, often an organizational model was followed that was more free market oriented because it served the colonizers. Many of these states, and I think I'm thinking of Zambia specifically as a very good example, post-independence immediately went the other way and decided to nationalize resources, and it actually went quite well for quite a long time in a system of nationalized resources until the state realized that this model of nationalized resources do not serve the purposes for which they chose this particular policy. And then what happens is law gets revised to favor a more free market approach. And that can go on for a couple of decades until the government realizes again, but a free market approach is also not solving the problems. And then they revert again to a more socialist or a more controlling system. And so the spiral goes from the one side of the spectrum to the other side of the spectrum and back again. Now, the researchers that work on this are very worried about this kind of spiral, because they say every time that the system changes, it causes additional cost. The infrastructure needs to be changed. The laws need to be changed. There needs to be new institutional capacity created to enforce a new system. And in and if a society spirals between these opposites, it is eventually it is going to be too costly to maintain, and it just contributes to creation of poverty of the state. So this is also something to keep in mind, especially if you are a decision maker in a state, and you have to make these kind of decisions, is how important is this change, and are we prepared for the costs that it will gain? Very particular views on this when it comes to introducing a new expropriation law that will have the potential and the power to change the society in the way in which the state imagines that it would be good for the society. So the last question I want to talk to you about is, can or may expropriate? And here it can get a little bit more technical, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it. The bill, clause 3 and 4, addresses this question actually in quite a lot. Question, who can expropriate? The Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure, or any other organ of state that can convince the minister that it needs to expropriate. The reasons why an expropriation or land or infrastructure needs of that particular organ of state. And what can be expropriated? A portion of land or the land in itself. Or if only is needed, but what remains behind is a completely useless, valueless for the property owner. The property owner can also ask for that to be expropriated. And then what happens after that, once it takes place, Ms. Paul will talk about this in more detail. Ownership vests, there's a possession date identified, the state becomes responsible for fees, duties and other payments, and the costs, there is also a model of allocating costs. The empowering legislation for expropriation, our core, sits in the Constitution in Section 25, 1 and 2, and Mr. Matiba will talk about that again. And at the moment,
Chairperson, we've lost the professor.
Yes, yes. Professor, we have lost you. Committee Secretary?
Chairperson?
Yes, we can't hear the professor.
Yeah, no, Dr. Back is following it up.
Okay, good. This is when they changed.
Can you not hear me? I can hear you. I can get an indication of whether you can hear me?
We can hear you now. We lost you, I suspect.
Right.
We lost you when you were talking about the empowering legislation, 25, 1 and 2. That's where we lost you. Section 25, section 1 and 2, that's where we lost you.
Indeed. Yes, so that was the Constitution. Yes, the Constitution is our right. We have good connection on this side.
We have lost the prof again.
Can you hear me? Hello? Can you hear me? Hello?
Can you hear you, prof? But I can't. Chairperson.
Can you watch now? Can you hear me?
All right. Okay, shall I continue?
Yes, you can continue, Prof. You can hear me.
Yes, I can hear you. I was saying that the Constitution, Section 25, 1 and 2, is where the right to expropriate is articulated now, and also the conditions under which the expropriation can take place. Mr. Matiba will deal with that in more detail, and Dr. Kramer. What I want to show you is this. At the moment, the Expropriation Act that supplements the Constitution is actually 20 years older than the Constitution itself. And a big part of why the revision of the Expropriation Act is necessary is to bring it in line with the Constitution. Another set of laws that permit expropriation is the Municipal Systems Act and the Municipal Structures Act. All of these provisions include the municipal power to expropriate. But apart from that, I want to show you the research we've done for this particular seminar. The researchers have gone and looked at all the laws in South Africa to identify in which laws there are powers to expropriate conveyed on specific departments. And I promise you, the list goes on and on. The Department of Public Works, obviously, this is who we are also talking about. But apart from that, Department of Agriculture, Land Reform and Rural Development, four acts that convey the power to expropriate. Department of Transport, two acts. Department of Water and Sanitation, two further acts. Economic Development, Mineral Resources and Energy, four different acts. The Department expropriates under various pieces of legislation. The Department of Sports, Arts and Culture, Department of Communications and Digital Technologies, Public Enterprises, Science and Technology, the list goes on and on. But I do want to ask you whether you notice whether anybody is absent from this list. I'll just go through it slowly again. It's absent.
There.
can expropriate, Chair.
Okay. Good. But I think that list, I think Janice, all right, yeah, you're right. Have you left the professor? Yeah, we have lost the professor. So now I see he's gone. Maybe you can just probably just wait a bit while the prof is trying to reconnect. Thanks, prof, you are back. We've lost you. Can you unmute, prof?
Yes, thank you, I hear you. We were here thinking about who is absent from the list of departments with the power to expropriate.
Local government.
Yeah, local government, we don't have the... Yes, so another one is, where is it now? Another one that is absent is the Minister of Police. So this is, so the Municipal Systems Act provides powers of expropriation at the municipal level, which I suppose can take care of some of what local government needs. The Minister of Police doesn't have the power to expropriate, not in terms of the acts applicable. And I suppose that is because there are other powers of that are assigned to the Minister of Police, for instance, those kind of powers. But very importantly also, police power was the ability to protect the freedom and the property of the people. Eminent domain is the power to take the property in the interests of the public. So this is where I would like to leave you, Chairperson. I am going to hand over to Dr. Richard Kramer, and I am also going to try to create a backup source of Wi-Fi in case the problem is on our side. So I will just turn this around so that Dr. Kramer can see.
Thank you, Prof. The floor is yours, Dr. Kramer.
Good morning, members of the committee. I will now be discussing what exactly can be expropriated, looking at both land as well as other constitutional property. So the starting point, I think, has got to be, what does the bill mention? What property in particular does the bill mention? The bill empowers expropriate property, but what exactly does it mean? So the starting point obviously would be land. The bill has a number of clauses which concern land specifically. For example, a clause which concerns valuation and investigation purposes. There's also a clause which requires consultation with municipalities and other organs of state that may be affected by expropriation of land. And also, where land is expropriated, there are additional notice requirements, additional parties who need to receive notices of intention to expropriate or a notice of expropriation. And obviously land in the current bill, there are specific clauses related to compensation which specifically relate to land. So land is a form of property which is explicitly mentioned in the bill. And the clauses that concern land are mainly procedural. But ultimately, land is not the end of it. Land is not the limit of the kind of property that can be expropriated in terms of the bill, even if it is perhaps the most important. So that requires us to consider what exactly is meant by property in the expropriation bill. The expropriation bill defines property as property as contemplated in Section 25 of the Constitution. So the bill itself has an open-ended definition of property. It doesn't give us a comprehensive, detailed definition. Instead, it points us to the Constitution. This is like one parent telling their child who's asked them for something to rather go ask the other parent about it. So then we are now pointed to the Constitution. And how does the Constitution define property? All the Constitution does is tell us that property is not limited to land. So ultimately, we have two very open-ended definitions of property. We have, on one hand, the expropriation bill, which tells us that property is property as contemplated in Section 25 of the Constitution. What's happening? Oh, sorry, I didn't realize you had to share the screen.
I think we've been sharing.
How do I get that?
Going.
Sorry, everyone, I didn't realize the screen share had been turned. It was past me.
We also neglected that because we are very audible. She is following.
What can you see now? Yes.
We can see now.
Okay, you can see the screen now. So let me just go back and show you my previous slide. So that was the previous slide dealing with land, and now we've come open-ended definition of we have this open-ended definition of property in both the expropriation bill and the Constitution. The expropriation bill just points us to the Constitution, which itself simply defines property as not being limited to land. So ultimately, we don't have a comprehensive, detailed definition of what exactly is property for both the expropriation bill as well as the Constitution. So that means we now need to start thinking about what exactly is constitutional property. The easy example is physical property, which aligns with the private law, property law definition of property, which
sort of lost you again, Bob. There is an intermittent disruption.
Switching on the audio on this side, maybe you can continue talking.
Can you hear me now?
This one's just the connection.
Yes, you are better now.
The screen is still shared.
Yes. Continue, because presentation Doc, are you still there?
Recording in progress. Can you hear me again?
Yes, we can hear you. Yes, we can hear you. We can see the screen. You have disappeared again. Am I the only one?
Okay, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you, Dr. Kramer.
Okay, so ultimately we need to consider what exactly is constitutional property. Property for the purposes of Section 25 of the Constitution. The easy example would be physical property. Corporeal property, as we were talking, property law. So physical property in private law, the law of property is primarily concerned with physical property and the rights people have in physical property. For example, your car. The car is an easy example of property that is would be considered, your ownership of your car would be considered constitutional property. But the Constitutional Court has said in FNB versus SARS decision that it's not possible, nor and it is judicially unwise to provide a provide a comprehensive definition of constitutional property. So ultimately, what is constitutional property will usually be decided on a case by case basis. We can provide some examples of non-physical, intangible property that have been or would easily be recognized as constitutional property. For example, rights to minerals granted in terms of the MPREA, other limited real rights and land such as servitudes. The Constitutional Court has also acknowledged a claim for unjustified enrichment to be constitutional property, and this means that debts or other claims that sound in money would likely be considered constitutional property as well. We've also had a case in which the Constitutional Court has acknowledged a liquor license to be property for the purposes of Section 25 of the Constitution, meaning that a liquor license would be protected against arbitrary deprivation. And then intellectual property or shares in a company would be quite easy examples of constitutional property. So while physical property is the heart of constitutional property, it is ultimately not the limit of constitutional property. We have a lot of non-physical, intangible rights that are increasingly economically valuable. And thus, it is necessary to protect those rights as constitutional property, as acknowledged by the Constitutional Court. And this includes even a right such as a liquor license, which it is usually subject to administrative cancellation, amendment, and regulation. So, we've defined constitutional property, but what exactly can be expropriated? Can anything that is considered constitutional property be expropriated? The bill does facilitate the expropriation of property in general, defines property as property for the purposes of Section 25 of the Constitution. But not everything that is considered constitutional property would necessarily be property for expropriation. The concept of constitutional property is very wide and includes rights which will likely never be considered in an expropriation context. It's easy to conceive of a car or land being expropriated, but how exactly would a liquor license be expropriated? Can it in fact be expropriated? Since the state usually regulates a liquor license through administrative law. So we have rights that are acknowledged as constitutional property, but might not necessarily be property for expropriation or ever be considered in the expropriation context. You have easy examples like your car or land, but then you have more tricky examples like a liquor license, which doesn't seem to really fit with property for expropriation, even if it is acknowledged as constitutional property. Why is this? Well, this comes down to the state acquisition requirements. Property in the bill is constitutional property, but constitutional property requires something more to be property for expropriation. This is the state acquisition requirement for expropriation. And ultimately, for property, for right to be property for expropriation, a right must be capable of acquisition. This means that in order for expropriation to occur, you must have, on one hand, a right that is considered constitutional property, and on the other hand, the state must acquire the substance of that right, as per the Constitutional Court in Agri SA. So we have a situation where for simple deprivation to rise to the level of an expropriation, you have to have both constitutional property and the state acquisition of the substance of that right or property. So this is a simple in the case of physical property. It's always possible for the state to acquire the substance of the ownership of land or the ownership of a car. But it's a bit more difficult when you get to the example like a liquor license. A liquor license has been acknowledged as constitutional property and is protected against arbitrary deprivation. But it's hard to conceive of how exactly the state could expropriate a liquor license. The state may withdraw, amend, or cancel a liquor license, but by doing so, it does not acquire the substance of such a right. So ultimately, the state acquisition requirement seems to operate as a brake on what kind of constitutional property can be considered property for the purposes of expropriation. So this brings us to the state acquisition and expropriation checklist. This provides a breakdown of state acquisition and expropriation. So we start with constitutional property. When we have a tangible property, the substance of a right, for example, ownership, can always be acquired by the state. And thus, it's always easy for tangible property such as land or car to be property for the purposes of expropriation. When we get to intangible property, it's a bit more tricky. There are a number of intangible rights, such as limited real rights in land, where or shares in a company where it's very possible for the substance of that right to be acquired by the state, and thus such rights can be property for the purposes of expropriation. However, in some cases, such as a liquor license, it's very difficult to conceive of how the state can acquire the substance of such a right that it usually can, through administrative law, regulate, amend, or cancel. The simple deprivation of a liquor license is very unlikely to ever rise to being an expropriation. So we have a very wide concept of constitutional property. But not all constitutional property is necessarily property for expropriation. when you consider the requirement that the state must acquire the substance of a right. In not every case, in not every right that is recognized as constitutional property can be acquired by the state. And that's where I am going to leave off and hand over to my colleague, Mr. Matiba, who will deal with when is it exactly expropriation.
Greetings, members of the Select Committee. Thank you once again for the opportunity. My name is Harper Lelwe Matiba, like Prof. Mostert has already introduced me. I would assume that at this point, we have already been taken through the different types of rights that can be expropriated by my colleague, Dr. Kramer. And earlier on, Prof. Mostert has laid a very detailed theoretical background and history of where does this power to expropriate actually comes from. And we are sitting here now today and we are deliberating upon the expropriation bill. And now one may want to ask what exactly is expropriation and when is it expropriation? So it is exactly what I will be contributing towards this discussion, to explain what expropriation means, the different elements or definitional elements of expropriation, and how expropriation actually differs from other forms of acquisition of ownership. And when I was busy, preparing for this session, I thought I should just like put this picture there. And you would see this picture actually depicts what actually expropriation would look like in the real world. You would see there are three arms of what seems like to be three gentlemen wearing suits. In a real world, those three arms would depict the state in the form of an expropriating authority. And you would also see three human beings there. The man who was, I would assume he was busy working the land, that seems to be a very well taken care of piece of turf, and the state is forcefully grabbing that land. And you see down here, there's a lady wearing purple, holding what seems to be a spade and pointing fingers, demonstrating aggression and anger. So that is basically what plays out in the real world, in the ground, whenever expropriation gets to be executed. Now, what is expropriation? In very simple terms, expropriation involves the unilateral state action that entails the acquisition, the compulsory acquisition of property, either in part or whole, that belongs to a private owner or any person who has a claimable right over that particular property for the purposes of public benefit, public use, or public interest, or in the public interest. That is basically what expropriation means. And I must emphasize the point here that at the center of expropriation, like Prof. Mostert highlighted earlier when she was dealing with the theory behind expropriation, lies a very critical element of public use and fairness. So those two elements play a very major role in determining the legitimacy of any expropriation act. Now, this brings us to this expropriation as deprivation. So Section 25 of the Constitution is clear. It's saying that no one may be deprived of their property, and that no law may permit arbitrary deprivation of property. Now we see here that in our current legal framework, the Constitution and other subsidiary legal framework provide for different forms of deprivation, and expropriation is just a sub-theme or subset of that host of deprivations. Now, like I said, that Section 25.1, it provides that no one may be arbitrarily deprived of their property. the section does not really go beyond that. Even the Expropriation Act itself, it doesn't go beyond that to actually explain what exactly is deprivation. But then in the VAST theory, the property law theory has actually over the years come to acknowledge or recognize that there are two different types of deprivation. The deprivation may be substantive in nature or otherwise procedural. There's no clear differentiation or distinction of between these two in the law. But then our jurisprudence, the Constitutional Court in particular, has contributed quite significantly towards building a knowledge-based jurisprudence that actually gets to guide when exactly can we say that deprivation is arbitrary in a substantial sense and also in a procedural sense. Okay, now this goes to the definitional elements or characteristics of expropriation. How do we tell that this is expropriation? How do we say that this particular deprivation is expropriation? And these are the key elements that set expropriation different from other modes of acquiring property. Like I said, in my earlier definition, simplest definition of what property basically would mean in a layman language. The first element is, of course, it involves the original acquisition of ownership, of which, Dr. Kramer said, it usually involves land, although we know by now that constitutional property is not only concerned with land, but it can be interpreted more broadly. But we know that for the purposes of this bill, most of one would ordinarily be inclined to assume that property in the context of this bill relates to land, as it has been quite debated for some time now. So the first element is, of course, it's an original acquisition of ownership that involves a unilateral state action. And what does that unilateral element mean? It means that the corporation of the previous owner or the current owner of the property is not necessarily a requirement here. And I would take you back to this picture here that depicts expropriation in the real world. You would see this woman here who's pointing fingers and demonstrating a great deal of anger and aggression. You can clearly see that there's no form of agreement here or meeting of minds between the lady and the three gentlemen who are grabbing their land, who seem to be the expropriating authorities. So it's a unilateral state action in that sense. And I must also add here that the expropriating authority might actually expropriate the land for public benefit, for public purpose, and it may actually get to later on make that property to vest on a third party transfer for economic development, whether directly or indirectly. So that is the first element of it. It must be, lead up to the original acquisition of ownership. And the second characteristics is that the person executing expropriation must be someone who's acting on public authority, and the decision to expropriate is administrative in nature. And for that fact, it means that such particular decision, although it operates within Section 25, a realm of the Constitution and of course the Expropriation Act, such particular decision must also satisfy the requirements that are stipulated in Section 33 of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. So the decision to expropriate must meet the PAJA requirement, just like any other administrative decision in a different context. So the person must be acting in public authority. It might be, we know by now that the bill actually vests or clothes the Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure with those powers, but then those powers, the Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure may actually get to to delegate those powers to other organs of state, as the case might be. And then the third element is that the expropriation must only be executed if it has been established that the end result is for public purpose, or is to benefit the public. So there must be a very strong element of public purpose or public interest. And this is where, like Prof. Mostert has argued earlier, this is where the legitimate justification of expropriation element comes in, to say, yes, we know that the state is vested with these powers to expropriate the compulsory takings of property, private property, but then to ensure that there is no misuse and abuse of this power, how do we actually guard against the state misusing this power? And this is where the legitimacy test question comes to play, and I will be explaining this shortly. And the fourth element is that expropriation must take place or must happen by operation of law. In other words, there must be an enabling legislation that provides or that authorizes such particular expropriation to take place. We have already took you through a vast list of legislation that cloth different departments with the power to expropriate. That is a good thing, because it indicates that the power to expropriate by different departments, it is not exercised from a hollow, but there's actually the enabling legislation that provides for that. And then there's another element which is critical, and I think I've also quite emphasized this earlier when I was explaining the picture, the depiction, that it oftentimes happen against private owners' will. What this means is that, like any, you know, most of the original acquisition of ownership methods, it doesn't necessarily require the cooperation of the current owner of the land or the property. So it will happen forcefully whether the current owner is cooperating or not. And then the last element is, of course, as provided by our Constitution, Section 25, Subsection 2, there must be payment of just and equitable compensation. This is, you know, the best practice so far when compared to other jurisdictions that are also having a similar, you know, mechanism of the power to expropriate in their constitutional property frameworks. So these are the main elements that sets expropriation different from other modes or methods of acquiring property in an original manner. Okay, I have indicated earlier that we have to guard against the legitimacy of expropriation actions, so that the state does not actually get to abuse or misuse this machinery. And like I've said earlier, we know by now that expropriation is just a subset of a host of deprivations that are currently provided for in our legal framework. But then how do we know that a particular expropriation act is legitimate? In other words, it is done for good reasons, and it is not just the state, the relevant state authority or the expropriating authority abusing or misusing this power. So our courts have established the legitimacy test for expropriation, which basically entails two legs. The one leg lies on the realm of rationality, and the other one lies on the realm of proportionality. On the rationality element of the test, what the court really would be obsessed with here is the suitability of the property that is targeted for expropriation to achieve whatever the intended objectives are for that particular expropriating authority. If the court is established, I mean, if the court is convinced under certain circumstances that the property that the expropriating authority is targeting to achieve a particular objective is sufficient enough or is meets what it would under normal circumstances consider as meeting the threshold of suitability, then such expropriating authority has went one step ahead towards proving the rationality of the decision to expropriate. So the property that is targeted for expropriation must be suitable to achieve the intended objectives that the expropriating authority have in mind when they start to execute or think about expropriation. And the second subrealm is the availability of sound reasons. Like I said earlier, the decision to expropriate does not just happen in a hollow space. There must be compelling reason, sufficient substantive reasons that goes to justify why expropriation as opposed to any other form of achieving whatever the intended objective might be. So for rationality lack, you have to establish the suitability of the property to meet the intended objectives, and the sound reasons must be there. The court must be convinced with the reason that the expropriating authority advances for the expropriation to take place. That is with the rationality. And then it comes to the proportionality, which is the second leg of the legitimacy test. The proportionality leg actually concerns itself with the question of whether does the end justify the means? And what does this mean in real terms is that here the court would be engaged in a balancing exercise where they will have to balance the benefits that stand to be derived if the expropriation is to proceed against the adverse impact that the expropriation action would actually result into if it eventually succeeds. So it is just the question of balancing the conflicting interests that are immediately involved whenever the question of expropriation is involved. The benefits, do they outweigh the adverse impact? If they do, then the proportionality leg is satisfied and the court can give the expropriating authority a go-ahead with the expropriation action. So this is how currently in our jurisprudence the legitimacy of expropriation as a deprivation is gauged or established. And now what happens if a particular expropriation action does not really meet the legitimacy test? Then that would mean that such expropriation is arbitrary. And we know that our constitution does prohibit arbitrary deprivation of property in very strict and strong terms. And now how do we gauge the arbitrariness of such decision to expropriate? Again, the test here for arbitrariness also takes the form of two legs. On the one hand, we have the substantive arbitrariness, and on the other, we have procedural arbitrariness. As for substantive arbitrariness here, the court that would be approached to determine whether a particular expropriation action is arbitrary or not, the first thing that such particular court will have to do will be to establish whether the arbitrariness is substantive. And what would it look like when such arbitrariness is substantive? There will be lack of sufficient reason, and there will be poor justification of such expropriation. So like I said earlier, by virtue of it being an administrative decision, the power to expropriate being an administrative decision, it has to follow the PAJA framework that basically explains why the key tenets of public decision making or law making there must be sufficient reason to explain whatever the decision that the state authority has taken. there must be proper justification for that. If there are lack of sufficient reasons, if there's poor justification, then of course the court is more likely to arrive at the conclusion that such expropriation is arbitrary, at least in substantive sense. And then we tap again on the procedural arbitrariness. And here it's all about procedure. We have also the case of Mkhontwana, where the Constitutional Court gets to actually deal with what procedural arbitrariness exactly means in the context of Section 25(1) and 2. And what the court seemed to be aligning itself with the view that says that procedural arbitrariness is as seen within the broader, a much more wider scope of procedural fairness as developed in administrative law. So here, although the expropriation decision would ordinarily be residing within Section 25 and of course the Enabling Expropriation Act, but then to determine the procedural fairness of that decision, the court will have to step out of Section 25 and the PAJA, and Section 25 and the Expropriation Act, and step into the PAJA to determine whether such arbitrariness whether such expropriation was procedurally fair, and if the test is positive, then of course the court is unlikely to rule or approve the decision to go ahead with expropriation. Yeah, so far we know what are the key characteristics of expropriation. How do we know that a particular act of expropriation is legitimate or not? And now it is only fair that we then proceed now to deal with the stages that are involved in the expropriation process. How do we go about, how does the expropriating authority go about executing expropriation? And the first stage here is, of course, the investigation and valuation stage. This is the pre-expropriation stage. And I think I must emphasize here and plead for the Select Committee's attention here that this is particularly important because in the current Expropriation Act that we are having at the moment, there's no provision for pre-expropriation stage. There's no investigation and valuation stage. So this is a new occurrence that the bill stands to contribute towards our legal framework around expropriation. So it must be viewed as a welcome occurrence. And I would be just trying to glimpse all over these five stages. There's the subsequent five slides, each explains what goes into each of these stages. But for the sake of time, I'll just like quickly browse this. And I would assume that you have just already engaged with the slides, and you'll be able to just ask me questions on each of the stages if maybe you feel like there's some technical issue that you might need some further clarity on. But the message that I really want to convey with this expropriation process as contained in the bill is that I'm very much certain that the expropriation bill and the process that it provides for are very much geared towards achieving fairness, which is a very critical barometer for a legitimate practice of expropriation. So the investigation and valuation process, like I said, it precedes the actual expropriation in a sense that here the expropriating authority must ascertain different things, quite a number of things. One of those is the suitability of the property for the intended objectives, and must also ascertain themselves of any unregistered rights that exist in respect of a particular property and the impact of those rights on the intended use of the expropriated property. So those are some of the ascertainments that the expropriating authority must ascertain in advance before he can actually proceed with the serving of notice of intention. And it is also at this stage the investigation and valuation where the expropriating authority may also conduct consultations with the municipality, and correspondence in that regard may be made with the municipal manager, the municipality within which the expropriated property is located. And the idea here is simply like to find out from the municipal manager, how is this intended expropriation of this particular property going to affect your municipal planning? And the municipal manager will obviously advise the expropriating authority to say, okay, no, the municipality had this kind of planning for that particular property, but if none whatsoever, then the expropriating authority is safe to proceed. And the second stage is now the serving of notice of intention to expropriate. Now, once the investigation and valuation stage is done, the next step for the expropriating authority is to serve the notice of intention to expropriate on the owner of the property or any other person who has a claimable right over the property that is targeted for expropriation. And here, what the notice of intention to expropriate must include certain things, such as, the statement of notice of intention to expropriate. That is basically to say why the notice is there. And of course, after serving like the notice on the owner and any other person who has a right, such notice must be made public. It must be publicized so that the public and interested parties can actually get to lodge whatever comments, objections, and submissions they may have. So the notice of intention to expropriate must contain, like I said, the statement of notice of intention to expropriate, basically the purpose of the notice. Why am I reading this notice? And it must also have a full description of the property that is targeted for expropriation. It must have the reasons for such expropriation, the intended use of that property after it is successfully expropriated, the estimated date, and if possible time within which the vesting of rights will actually get to happen, and other things such as the locality of the property, any other thing, permanent attachments to that particular property, any other information that may be of relevance to a particular scenario. And once that is done successfully, the third stage of the process entails the notice of expropriation. And this is where now the real expropriation takes place. This is where the actual taking of the property happens. And the expropriating authority must accept this notice again on the owner of the property targeted or any other person who has a claimable or enforceable right in respect of that targeted property. And of course, the notice of expropriation, just like that of intention to expropriate, must also be made public for interested parties to make note, if any, their comments, submissions, and objections against that intended action. What does the notice of intention, notice of expropriation include? It includes, there's a strong commonality between this notice of expropriation and that of notice of intention to expropriate. But here, the notice of expropriation must include details such as the description of the property, obviously, you know, the suitability of that property to achieve the intended objectives that the expropriating authority has in mind, and also the date, importantly, the date in which the expropriating authority will actually be coming to claim the right of possession over that expropriated authority, which is very critical because the owner or any person who's in charge of the property must be aware of when exactly the expropriating authority will be claiming possession over that respective property. And of course, the fourth stage is the verification of any unregistered rights on property. This is another very critical fairness safety net that the bill provides, because here what the logic behind this stage is basically to invite those uncompensated unregistered rights holders to come forth and submit their claims against the expropriating authority for the possible compensation. And if their claim actually succeeds, that's when now they can start engaging in a process of negotiating if the expropriating authority is amenable to such, the negotiation of compensation. And if all goes well, having submitted, of course, evidence that goes to prove the existence of their unregistered rights on the targeted property, then of course compensation follows, as if they were known at the beginning of the process. And the last stage, of course, is the determination of compensation. And of course, what we know in our current system is that one of the factors that we consider when we determine the value of compensation that is payable under certain circumstances is, of course, we consider the current use of the property and how does that the economic potential of that particular property and other relevant factors as may be you know valued or surveyed by the people with the necessary expertise and speciality, of which the minister is again, or the expropriating authority is again empowered to solicit the service of those kind of professions to come and actually assist with the valuing of the land, the surveying of the land, and all those kind of stuff. So, like I said, that is in a nutshell the process, how it goes. But I'm happy to actually tap into finer details in respect of each stage, if members of the committee may be of interest to a particular stage of the process. I'll be happy to take questions and to actually drill deep on any of the technicality that members might be having. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Let's go back to Professor Moslet.
Yes, colleagues, this is more or less the end of our presentation for you. I have a couple of concluding questions to the committee, but I'm sure maybe the committee would also have questions. So here are some of the things I think one should be thinking about. How does political affiliation or conviction influence the understanding of expropriation? How does the civil service or the bureaucracy view expropriation? What do you think is important for the public at large in respect of expropriation? And how do you think affected owners view the expropriation? But I'll leave it to you to give us questions if you want to. We also can recommend further reading, and we can make available a reading pack if you would wish that. But for now, we say thank you.
Thank you, Prof, for the comprehensive presentation that you have outlined with your team. I believe it came in handy in view of the next meeting that we're going to have. I will then invite members for
note that three heads, to be Honorable Dango, and then Honorable Mokheti, and then Honorable Alan
Fox.
The Fox. Okay, let's go in that way. And then it will be Honorable Aflame. Let's go in that fashion. Honorable Dango?
Chairperson, thank you very much. I want to put a practical issue before the presenters. First, I want to thank them for their presentation. I take the practical issue of the land in Salt River, where there's a club on, and the land is intended now to be developed into a very major industrial and shopping center for Amazon. But the land that is intended to be built upon, culturally, the Khoisan people have always been connected to that piece of land, and it was taken away from them at the time when there was no individual land register. It was collective land. If they want to actually now claim that land back without compensation for their cultural purposes and possibly for development purposes, how would they go about it? Because they were dispossessed of land. The land was not, there was no land registered at the time of dispossession. They now, and have historically, had a cultural link to there, and now want to actually claim that back. How would they go about doing that for them? Because I think this is the history of South Africa, and I think the history that is going to be very difficult, that we're going to have to deal with, and sensitive, because we need to deal with the sensitivities of people who have been dispossessed in the past. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Dambo, Dr. Mokheti.
Would you like us to take all the questions first, or do them one by one?
Let's take all the questions, Prof. Let's take all the questions. Dr. Mokheti?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I don't see if my camera is on or what, but I would request to switch it off for a better connection, because where I am, I've got load shedding now. If you allow me.
Yes, no problem with that.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me first take this opportunity to thank Prof and all other presenters. Chair, I think it is an eye-opener for all of us. And my question for clarity, Chair, would relate to what Mr. Matiba has said with regards to expropriation against the owner's will. We are faced with a challenge of shack farming in the country, where you find that the owner of the land is either in Netherlands or US or any other country, but you find that land, there are shacks that are mushrooming, and it is well coordinated. You can see that this is a well orchestrated type of invasion of land. So where we find, sometimes we find that they invade prime land. When you go along the N12, you see that there are shacks on the mountain, and for me, I view that as prime land that can be used for proper housing, where at least the municipality can generate income and also use it maybe for their own use. And in some instances, you'll find that there are people who are coordinating this. You'll find that they also connect electricity. They somehow legally connect water. And in some instances, along the N12 Joburg, again, there is the sheikhs that are mushrooming there, and they are in a very unsafe land. And when there are floods, you might find that the whole sheikh can be like taken by water. So in that case, how does the bill assist government to expropriate land where someone is sitting somewhere overseas? And then I heard Mr. Matiba also saying that we can serve a notice for someone that maybe maybe the land that you want, you can serve a notice and give reasons why you have to expropriate. So how do we expropriate land of somebody that you cannot find anywhere in the country? And find that in some instances, there are few people who know the whereabouts of that person. So how does the bill assist us to expropriate in such cases? Thank you very much, Chair.
Chair, thank you very much. Alan Fuchs from Gauteng. I'm really interested to hear from Mr. Matiba the legal arguments around the question of fairness. In the event that a property has improvements and there's also a bond on that property, under what circumstances would it be argued to be fair that that property be expropriated, taking into account the fact that the bondholder in this case would no longer be able to utilize that property, and they would still be liable to pay the bond to the bank? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Honorable Apleni.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Let me first thank the team for the clear presentation. Now, Chairperson, let me first start by saying openly and without any fear that I'm not shocked to hear the comments that suggested that it would be better to expropriate land from the people who are occupying land. We have no houses. We have nowhere to go. We have seen the open land that is not being used and make a use of that so that they can be able to live with their families. So it is not shocking to find some taking that posture of seeing the land that is being occupied by those people as the land that should be expropriated instead of the land which was stolen by the land thieves, which should be expropriated in actual fact without compensation. But the question that I have, Chairperson, it is clear that from the presentation that expropriation is possible. But the question that I have is that what is hindering our government from expropriating our government and the municipalities, expropriating land for development? Because we have places where schools cannot be built, where the government wants to expand the roads or build new roads that they can't. And in most cases, you would find out that even the people who are actually occupying such land in which it is difficult for our government to develop, that majority of those people don't even have the title deed for the land that they are occupying. So what is it that is stopping our government from doing so? Is it so difficult for the government to expropriate the land in which some of the occupants of that land do not even have title deeds? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Pleni. Honorable Chawalala.
My
apology, Honorable Chair. I am just struggling with the network. Let me also take this opportunity, Chair. It's Honorable Tshabalala from the Free State. It was just an unfortunate. I want to appreciate the presentation. I think the problem of load shedding, where I was unable to hear very clearly. But taking a cue from what has been presented, I wanted just to ask in terms of the municipal tribunals. I think in the first presentation it was a little bit of touch. And just to see, Chair, on how this section talks to the level of municipalities at that level of municipal tribunals, on how these tribunals would be assisted in this matter of expropriating land. So I just wanted to hear if is there any framework that would be able to assist, because if you look at now, Chairperson, the most of the municipal tribunals, some you have people who did not, you know, who do not qualify in terms of the requirements, and how that would also assist in terms of correcting that. So that is just the clarity I wanted to ask. Generally, would appreciate if we could also have the presentation so that we are able to make follow-ups to the relevant stakeholders that we're doing the presentation. And thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Tshabalala. Honorable Baptist.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I am still struggling with signal. So if you can hear me, and I do apologize for any background noise, I hope you can hear me okay, Chairperson. I have a number of high-level questions. So
I wonder.
Panel can just. Are you able to hear me?
Struggling to hear.
Are you struggling to hear?
All right. So, are they struggling to hear me?
This works.
Chairperson, is that better?
Yes, we can hear you. But it looks like the chin that side is struggling. But we can hear you.
Chairperson, is that better?
Yes,
we're
struggling to hear now.
Right, Chairperson. Chairperson, first of all, I'd like to just thank the panel for their presentation. It's extremely interesting. I'm sure to yourself as a person with a legal background, it's been very interesting. My first question is, well, the bill specifically says that property can be expropriated for public purpose and public interest. So my first question to the panel is, who determines public purpose and who determines public interest? That's the first question. The second question, perhaps to Dr. Kramer specifically, is why is the bill so wide in terms of property definition? And why would the expropriating authority want to expropriate intangible assets, movable assets, intellectual property, etc.? Because the preamble to the bill is Section 25, and one of the biggest motivations for the bill is land reform, which we have no problem with. But why then expand it out to be able to expropriate a person's business, expropriate their piece of art, expropriate a book that they've made, try and repurpose a business for another decision? So the question really is why on earth would the expropriation laws be so wide? And I love Dr. Kramer's interpretation is that referring a question from one parent to another. And so the question also, allied, linked to that is, if it is so wide, is it constitutional? Will it pass constitutional muster? Then the other question is, now you have Mr. X or Mrs. X owning a piece of property. Government comes along and says we want to expropriate. They go through all the steps that Mr. Matiba set out. But what protection do they have to defend that in court? Because defending it in court places a massive onus on the property owner to actually defend that in court. And in most cases, Chair, they simply would not have the resources to do so. So what level of protection does exist for the property owner allows to defend this in court And previous decision, in fact, was not rational. Previous decision was not proportional. And then my final question is, maybe to Mr. Matsiba, is can you please go through that determination of compensation stage? Because that Section 12C provides, creates great uncertainty, especially in line with the entire idea that property may be expropriated with nil compensation. And so if we could just get a much larger explanation of the determination of compensation and what factors are at play there. Thank you very much, Chair. I'm sorry for the background noise and my lack of sleep. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim. It's just a question from my side. The current Expropriation Act, which was correctly pointed out that it is 20 years older than the Constitution. The question that I want to pose is, has there been enough litigation on the matter, on cases on this on expropriation on this old regime? And if it is not enough, could the reason be attributed to the fact that the current regime does not make provision for the for Section 25? It came before that. And then one of the issues that you raised was that you raised an issue around the influence. I mean, among those issues that you raised relates to the two extremes, the big state and the small state, which obviously I think is more ideological. Which Professor Monster has indicated that it could play a role in terms of your appreciation and comprehension of expropriation. But given the fact that our state is constitutional, we are following constitutional democracy instead of parliamentary democracy, which is practiced in other countries like the UK. Do you think that that those extremes are relevant, given the fact that as a constitutional state, first and foremost, whatever you do in terms of as a state, in terms of administrative action, it must be preceded by the values that are enshrined in the Constitution, which among them include the issues of rationality and transparency that you have referred to. But more than that, the supremacy of the Constitution, meaning that if a local government or a department takes a decision that is irrational, where there is no connection between the decision that we take and the facts before you, definitely the probabilities of that decision being set aside by a court of law is guaranteed, because you would have acted irrational, and having acted irrational and not in a transparent way, you would have definitely undermined the Constitution. You would have undermined the rule of law. Therefore, the question is it still necessary as a starting point
to factor those two extremes, or let alone conceptual understanding of a state or a classless society, which obviously, like I guess you said, the reality of the matter is from those that comes from the big state, their point of departure is the base, is the economic base, and the issue is that the base will always reflect the superstructure, meaning that the dominant class in the mode of production will influence the type of politics or polity or state that debates. The hands are saying that it is really necessary to go to that, given the fact that the framework of our state is enshrined in the Constitution. Thank you. You can take the floor, Prof.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Prof.
Thank you very much, colleagues, for all of the questions. Perhaps you'll allow me to moderate just that we can decide who answers what. I'm going to start with the first question, which was about our community in Salt River and their ability to have the land expropriated for development purposes, but also for cultural purposes. I'm very glad that the question came up, because in preparing for our presentation to you, we were wondering in how much depth we should go in. And one of the topics that landed on the cutting floor was the possibility of expropriating for third parties. So I am going to ask Mr. Matiba to say a few words about that, but just to say that the system, the process does envisage the possibility of expropriation for restitution purposes, which it sounds to me as if this community would qualify for that, and it also enables, the system also enables the possibility of the state expropriating for the benefit of a third party, such as a community that receives that should receive their land back because of restitution. It even provides the possibility of expropriation for the benefit of a developer, and we have some examples in that regard as well, but I'm not going to say anything now because there's another question that deals with that, but I'll just hand over to Mr. Matiba to say something about the community rights.
Yes, thank you so much, members of the committee, for the questions. Yes, indeed. Prof. Mostert has actually said mostly, just very briefly, about third-party transfers, which I think the question by the first member of the committee relates to. I think I should just add maybe on that to say that the bill actually does empower the expropriating authority to expropriate property for third-party transfers, and that is in cases where maybe there's economic development adventures that such third-party presents to the expropriating authority. And of course, that community, if it is having the rights on that property on the basis, if their rights are claimable or enforceable in the basis of IPILRA, that is the interim protection of informal land rights, they also have kind of a safety net in that statute to actually enforce their rights on land. And but yeah, for restitutionary purposes, the bill is very much clear. Yeah, on that. And then I thought I should just add on that insofar as the third party transfers is concerned. I'll give back to Prof. Mostert to just finish with her questions, and then I'll proceed later with other questions that were directed to me. Thank you.
Yes. So thank you, Matipa. Our next question was about expropriation against the owner's will where the owner cannot be found. We have to deliberate that a bit. My sense of that is there is a formal way of finding the owner in that the owner, the landowner, will have a registered domicilium address in the land register. So even if the owner cannot physically be found, there is a place where the owner can legally be found and where the expropriation notice can be served. Am I correct?
Yes, that is very correct, Prof. And members of the committee might actually have heard that in some part of the process of expropriation, the verification and the investigation, which is the pre-expropriation process, one of the entities that the expropriating authority must actually consult with is the DIS office. And of course, the DIS office will be in a much better position to actually provide the most updated details of that owner, even if he is currently abroad and not within the borders of the Republic. So the domicilium that will be registered at the DIS office, that is where the notice of intention, or let alone the notice to expropriate, may actually get to be served on that owner. Otherwise, but this is the extreme now scenario, the expropriating authority may resort to actually institute eviction proceedings in terms of Section 6 of the PI, that is the Prevention of Illegal Evictions Act, to actually get to evict those unlawful occupants from the land that is targeted for expropriation. The state is very much, clushed with the necessary powers to institute those kind of proceedings. And I would assume that if the owner is not around and there are a lot of mushrooming squatter camps in the land that belongs to that particular owner, then the state has a valid leg to stand on and invoke Section 26 of the PI to actually effect evictions of those people.
Thank you. And then there's also the element to that question, which I think is very interesting and which should be raised, is the underlying concern. It struck me as being that informality is taking over on vast tracts of our land. Informal settlements are emerging. The word mushrooming was used, and I think that is a very valid concern. What happens with informality, when informality takes over, the state loses its power. And we're returning back to, if you can remember the slide that we had in the beginning, with the two pies on them. Where is that now? We're returning to what Epstein would call a state of nature, where everybody is fending for themselves and everybody is protecting their own rights, and there is no mention-worthy state to think of. And it's a matter of great concern where informality is taking over in a system where there is supposed to be a state which can protect and which can regulate. So that is an important question, and I think for the committee members specifically thinking about the role of the state and the responsibility of the state also in that context. The next question was about the arguments around the question of fairness, and specifically the way in which bondholders and other right holders are affected when property is expropriated. Now, Mr. Matiba had a specific slide prepared for that. I'm sure he would love to show that, so I'm just going to hand over to him again.
Yes, thanks, Honourable Member, for that question on the fairness as it relates to the mortgage bond holders in the event whereby the mortgaged property is subject for expropriation. I think there's somewhere, I think it is in one of the slides where I didn't go much into detail, where it's actually, here is the slide. So I did say here in the procedural arbitrariness part that the main barometer here that plays in the legitimacy or, assessing whether the extent of arbitrariness of a particular expropriation act is how fair was that decision, or how fair is the process, was the process that led to that decision being taken. But I wish to reiterate this point and say to you that the bill actually anticipates that, you know, the land or the property that is mortgaged might actually be the target for expropriation. And for that regard, it acknowledges that the bondholders or the bond owners or someone who has the bond registered on their name is targeted property must also be served on the, with the notice. And when you look closer again to, at chapter 5 of the bill, it's all about compensation. It explains all the technicalities around the compensation for expropriation. And I love the wording of the bill here, because it says that the amount of compensation to be paid to an expropriated owner or holder must be just and equitable, reflecting an equitable balance between the public interest and the interest of the expropriated owner or expropriated holder. In this case, who might be the someone who is currently servicing the bond in respect of a piece of land that is now being going to be taken away by the state. So here, the whole notion is simply to say that the bill is mindful that both interests must be considered. And I said that when it is the role of the court, if maybe the aggrieved party may want to actually, you know, litigate this, challenge the decision to expropriate and bring that challenge before the court. It will be the question before the court to actually determine the question, does the end justify the means? And if the court answers that question not in the affirmative, then it means that the rights or the interest of the mortgage holder will then be respected, or will then be retained in that way. Because then what the court would then arrive at, what would be the order of the court would then reach the decision to say that expropriation under that given circumstances may not hold or may not proceed. So the bill actually does have a very good acknowledgement of the interest of people who might actually be servicing the bonds currently in respect of the land or properties that might be targeted for expropriation.
Thank you very much. Yes, that was a very thorough exposition. Our next question was about the question. I read the question as being basically what is taking the government so long? What is stopping them from expropriating, and specifically for purposes of economic development? I think that is also a very valid question. And I think it ties up with another question that was asked about understanding public purpose and public interest in the context of expropriation. So I'll take a shot at this, and if any of my colleagues want to add, then maybe just give me an indication. Public purpose and public interest is one of the parameters of fairness in the expropriation process, and that is what drives decisions to expropriate. These decisions about what is in the public interest and what is in the what could be a public purpose has been the subject of a lot of investigation, and for the South African context specifically, I undertook an analysis of all of the court cases that considered public purpose and public interest in expropriation matters a while ago. What was very interesting for me to see was that the public interest requirement was introduced by the Constitution. In the Expropriation Act, this fairness requirement is articulated as a public purpose requirement. And the Expropriation Act, written 20 years ago, before we had land reform, before we had restitution, before we had a constitution, was very much focused on what I would refer to as standard bread and butter kind of expropriations, to build a road, to build a hospital, that kind of thing. introducing public interest through the Constitution was specifically also geared towards opening up the expropriation process to enable transformation. What was very interesting looking at the court cases, though, was that all the transformative issues, restitution, land reform, housing, eviction, all of those questions where they bump up against expropriation questions, the court used not the public interest standard but the public purpose standard to resolve the matter. And very interestingly, in newer cases around expropriation for economic development, expropriation for third parties, or change of the purpose of expropriation, the court used the public interest parameter to evaluate the situation. That is a strange anomaly, and that is what we are sitting with at the moment. But the good news is our public purpose, public interest parameter is wide enough to encompass both the standard economic based expropriations as well as transformation.
Recording in progress.
Expropriation.
So I think in terms of the law, nothing is standing in the way of getting the government to introduce a model of economic development that would benefit all of the people of South Africa. I also want to add that the government governs not only the people that voted it into power, but all of the people in its particular realm.